On Tuesday, October 11th, 1966, in an evening convocation held at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, a lecture was delivered by the Reverend Dr. William Esch, who spoke on the topic, The Present State of German Theology. Dr. Esch is being introduced by Professor Herbert Bowman.
Gentlemen, we want to make use of every precious minute we have. The name Esch and its most recent appearance on the campus stood for basketball and student activities. An illustrious nephew of Dr. Esch, Norbert. I don't know if Dr. Esch ever played basketball or he ever participated in student activities, but he made his way in another way. He was born in Colorado and raised in Illinois and Wisconsin, went to Milwaukee and this seminary, and he spent many years in England and Germany. He was active in a literary way 30 and more years ago. I think there was a little pamphlet called The Crucible, which had you for its author. He wrote some articles for the CTM, and he has always been, throughout his career, a very acute observer of the theological scene, and has never been afraid to be critical of the theological scene, and has now for many years been professor of systematic theology at Oberursel near Frankfurt, and editor of the paper of the German Free Churches, the theological journal, the Theresa Rundblick. He has delivered innumerable lectures and papers, and has continued to observe the theological scene, is very widely read, and is prepared to give us a real insight into the theology as it has appeared, particularly in Germany, for the last half century. So it gives me great pleasure to present to you Dr. William Esch.
Before we start, I would like to say that Dr. Esch will speak for about 50 minutes or so, and that will give you an opportunity to ask questions or have some discussion until 8 o'clock.
Dear fellow Christians, dear and professors of this most honored institution, and especially dear students, and also dear pastors at large and in parishes so far as they are. I'm charged first to present greetings. They're the greetings of our institution, of course, and our free churches, and above all, of three men whom you may know in this way or that way. There's the greetings of Dr. Kirsten, who is here, one of my colleagues, and of Dr. Rensch, another one of my colleagues who spent, I think, a half a year here, if I'm right. Yeah. Or a quarter. Yeah. And then also the greetings of a man who for many years was vice president and president of one of the free churches of the Saxon Free Church, and who writes a lot, Dr. Heinrich Stahlmann. Altgräfisch. So they send their special greetings. Now, I am very happy to be privileged to speak here for the second time. I was here once in 58, speaking to the students, and being an alumnus of this institution myself, and now almost for 20 years handling students in Germany, I hope that I will not be too far away from what the Germans call meine lieben Kommilitonen. Which means, my dear co-combatants, my dear fellow fighters, those are the students, and that is the German address to students. Now, I'm sorry to say that I was not at your devotions and so forth, because I was in a sort of a sick state. My stomach all of a sudden didn't work on this little trip of or 20 days. And so I put out a little, and had to see to it that I would be fit again for this evening. I'm very thankful to the Bartlings that they took care of me in a wonderful way, as always. Now, the theme is the present state of German theology. And this is, of course, to be portrayed on the background of Germany's church conditions, because you can't treat it in any other way. But my aim, at the same time, is only to emphasize the present 1966 state of theology itself. Now, this present state is unique. What we have is a recurrence of Kirchenkampf. Quite a surprising thing in an affluent society with any without any political pressure. I'm referring, of course, in the first case to the western part of Germany. The fight that is now coming on, a sort of a major war, which is afoot, is directed against existentialist theology. And it is the best, you might say, place where to stand in order to get the theological positions both to the left and to the right. And it poses also in other countries, and in particular to the church operating at this seminary, certain essential questions. In the foreground now, as the butt of the attack of faith, is Bultmann in the person of the post-Bultmannites. Insofar as these post-Bultmannites are true to the neoliberal system. On the other hand, the neo-Orthodox leader, Karl Barth, has been moved away a little, almost into a side room, as once a great possibility, which some now try to move forward again as a sort of a harmonizing factor. A harmonizing factor which is still existentialistic, but would also satisfy, in a sense, the believers in creeds and so forth. And in the third place, then, there are advocates of other theological positions, some Lutherans. But they have only partly or partially emerged. So in the limelight are the Bultmannites, with Bultmann as the spiritus rector. And, of course, their direct opponent. And that is the war. So then my theme could be stretched just a little by two words and could be made to read the present state of war of German theology. This would be more exact. I know that to make the present church and university situation of a country altogether, you might say, structured in different ways, really intelligible, I ought to go into a historical introduction, and Germans are famous for that. And I will leave that to your historical and systematic department, who have either done it already or shall do it in some way in the future. I will merely point to the one thing which is so totally different from the American scene, namely European territorialism. Of course, territorialism is my translation of the term, which would be the more exact German term right now, That is longest Kirchen tomb. The territory in this case refers to the parts of Germany which are called Länder. There's no map here of Germany, but it's not necessary either. Called Länder. For instance, Bavaria is a lump. That would be a territory. Or Hanover is a lump. Therefore, it would be a territory. And territorialism in Germany means that the church is attached to that lump. Now, I will explain that just a little more. Territorialism totally dominates Scandinavia even now. Because there, even the king is involved. Germany has no royal rulers anymore, or no princes. But territorialism, in a more subtle way, rules also in England and in Germany. Now, in Germany, in the West, 50% of the population are Roman Catholics. But also the other 50% will all say, I belong. You know what you want to in mission work. And you approach anybody. I don't want to go into the penitentiaries now, or into the worst districts of the city. You can approach anybody, and everybody says, I belong. You ask them about church, I belong. So if he doesn't belong to the Roman Catholic Church, normally, of course, he belongs to the other, and to the territorial church. You find no unchurched people in general. Although, of the evangelicals, only a tiny percentage bothers to go to church. That can go as far down in Berlin as less than 1%. And it can be much higher up in country areas of Württemberg, in country areas of Bavaria. It can run up to 10%, and they claim in Bavaria even as an average of 13%, although I don't believe it anymore. You see, they have these pendler, that is, the peasants who move out into the towns for work, and to that brings in an urbanized attitude into villages which before that had a very high percentage in going to church. But those are all rare exceptions. The great big average of Germany wouldn't be more than about 4% or 3%. Now, the acts which everybody requires are baptism and burial. And there's a strange superstition connected with the Christian burial. And then perhaps something in between yet. Perhaps solemnization of marriage, perhaps. And in Western Germany, mostly confirmation. Eastern Germany, confirmation is down to about, I suppose about 20% is being confirmed yet. Yeah. You can get out only by an act before court. Otherwise, you belong to the evangelical or Lutheran setup of that particular life. Of course, if you're the child of a member of the free church, you're free. They're not taken in again. Unless you declare so. They get about 10% of the total income tax of Western Germany. That is, of course, set up according to percentages and according to persons, just as you take it. In the case of firms, of course, of legal establishments, it simply goes by percentages between the Roman Catholics and the local territorial church. And that means the church as organized in the territory, not the local congregation. There's no such thing as a local congregation, really. That's a parish. Now, what I may add yet is that in this territorial setup, education plays a tremendous role. And that all education is paid for extra yet by the state, straight out of the state treasury. And this comprises religious instruction at all levels, starting with those that just go to school and ending with the college diploma. There's no fixed religious instruction at the university. You just enroll as you please. Now, in addition to that, general, you might say, educational program, the theological faculties at the state universities are, of course, another area of public maintenance by tax money. That takes so-and-so many millions more. And there's no theological professor in Germany, with the exception of people like me, and people at a few, very few other places, who do not simply live on straight government money and get salaries accordingly and privileges accordingly. Now, the strange thing is that the Roman Catholic Church has absolute control over all religious instruction, although the government pays it in the same way. And, for instance, the Roman Catholic professor of theology has to walk out at once and get no more money from the state the moment his so-called missio is withdrawn by his bishop. Whereas, as far as evangelicals are concerned, they have absolutely no control whatsoever, neither over religious instruction on the lower levels, nor over the professors of theology. But here the state alone has something to say. Of course, they may have some gentlemen's agreements, you see, like all over the world. But here they are not legally binding. Now, in addition to this, it might be well to say that, of course, then, if you have a setup like that, you have to take into consideration that the big movements of thought have a terrific effect on the church itself. Now, there has been no such an impact of thought, of a change in thought, as at the time of Enlightenment, or also called rationalism. That is, would be from 1750 on. And of course, we, in a certain sense, are still living in the era of rationalism. And since these are very cultured nations, like England and Germany too, no matter what the form of government may happen to be, the Weltanschauung, or the philosophy of the learned and highly educated upper circles of society, is more or less all pervading and is dominant. Now, since Immanuel Kant managed to be the determinant, the determinative factor twice, he managed to do that twice. Namely, first when he lived, and then again, when Hegelianism, Hegelianismus, could not keep up all of its speculative pretensions. Then all of a sudden, with a vengeance, Immanuel Kant came back. And that was after the middle of the last century. And without Immanuel Kant, there wouldn't be existentialism, because that thrives partly on the pattern of Kant. So since Kant came in twice, you have to figure with him in the church, in the church everywhere. Now, I could add this yet, that a writer whom you may know here in this country, Wallenstein, his book was published here by Concordia Publishing House. And the title of the book is The Word That Can Never Die, 1966. There I might remark that Wallenstein is quite right about the sharp Cartesian division of reality, which Kant enlarged upon and made it more binding yet, and which is a presupposition of all forms of Kantianism and post-Kantianism. And It's this way. That there is an out there capable of being measured by man, and there's an ethical autonomy within. So then, you really have man twice, measuring first everything that's beyond him or outside of him, and then secondly, also being an autonomous authority within. So in that setup, of course, man almost is tantamount to God. And you have an attached God. You can only have a God who is attached to this autonomous ego within. So there's always a correspondence set up already between God and man, as far as you can take God seriously. God can not break in from the outside. It's totally impossible. And a binding law cannot come from the outside either, but it must come from within. So this goes with the total picture of Kantianism and post-Kantianism. It's a tremendous division, but at the same time, man's on both sides. Praise God and man who does the most. Now, getting back to territorialism, I would like to say that also Lutheran churches are all territorial churches, with the exception, of course, of the Lutheran Free Churches. And they have about 80,000 members, mostly in the West, who go about things as you do here, who really go to church, and who train their own pastors, and who maintain their own pastors. They're churches who, before God, are responsible for themselves. Territorial churches are never responsible for themselves. But to a large extent, it is this general population under the territorial government, so to say, which is the other side of the picture and is directly responsible for the territorial church in some way. I'm not going to go into the Eastern situation with the great cloud of communistic and dialectical materialism hanging over that abandoned and enslaved part of Germany. I will merely say that atheist instruction on all levels has not been able to wipe out Christianity. Although there has also been a tremendous reduction in baptism. Less than 50% of the children are being baptized. They have this form of Jugendweihe in a place of confirmation. But for those who risk going, the word of God, where it is really preached, means so very much more than it did before. And perhaps, besides the free churches, the nucleus of what are still territorial churches will slough off territorialism, because it doesn't make any sense anymore to get money from the atheist communists. And it doesn't make much sense to have the atheist communists dominate the system of theological training. And now, I just have to refer to the fact that the cloud of Hitlerism also passed away, and there was a temporary stabilization of church affairs. And this temporary stabilization was a restoration. It was not a reformation. And what they restored was that usual picture of territorialism, of course not in the extreme form of the northern countries, but in the form that had developed in Germany. And another factor is very important. When they did restore, they set up, of course, this church called EKIT, Evangelical Church in Germany, Evangelische Kirche in Deutschland. And that at the same time accomplished a new thing. It really meant that in a much more effective form, the great Prussian Union was extended over all Germany, that is including now also all the Lutheran territorial churches. Since these churches are, by the first count, members of the Atheists. And by a second count, they are also members of an organization called United Evangelical Lutheran Church in Germany, FEST. But that is only by the second count. And they cannot walk out of the atheist. But they can leave the first. Now, many people were conditioned by the Kirchenkampf against Hitler. And when the Hitler Reich went down after 12 years instead of lasting 1,000 years, then they were hoping for greater independence and for more influence of the church. But hardly had the outward stabilization after World War II been successfully achieved when both in territorialism and in evangelical university theology, things took a decided turn to the worse. And this today, in 1966, has caused a sort of a toxin's alarum for a second Kirchenkampf, which is ringing through the country from one end to the other, and which is already vibrant also in the eastern zone. Now, what shocks to those who still believe in the three articles of the Christian faith, including not only Christian laymen, but above all also the real pastors, was a wholesale innovation. I don't want to say innovation, invasion. It was not strictly an innovation, it was an invasion. It was the invasion, I would say, on all levels of education and on all levels of practical congregational work of the theology of Bultmann and of the Bultmannites. For instance, the cops come back from school and they bring out the main point. And maybe only 6, 7 years old, and they bring out the main point in our family. They say, well, of course, the miracle never happened. And comes the Bedeutung sometimes, the significance of that miracle. And, of course, some of the teachers may not fully have comprehended what the big talk means, but they get it there. And then the other side of things is congregational life, and that is, of course, influenced also by big meetings like the meetings which they call the Kirchentag, where they have 10,000 of people coming from all sides and staying there for a whole week. Once in a while, you might say congregations of 50, 60,000 people and more yet, and then taking them into various divisions, departments, and so forth, and working with them, and they throw in Bultmannism, post-Bultmannism, straight into the Kirchentag. Now, one of the most interesting things was this, that in Cologne last time, they had, on the one hand, Willy Marxen of Münster, post-Bultmannite. And on the other hand, a female. She is a pupil of Bultmann and of Gogarten. Her name is Frau Dr. Zöller. O mit Umlaut. Frau Dr. Zöller. Now, the gist of what she presented to the bewildered lay people is contained in a book called Der Stellvertreter, which ought to be in your library already. I suppose it is. Der Stellvertreter. That's what she said at the Kirchentag too. And I'll just give you a rough idea. I just have the citus pages with me here. The rough idea of the thing is this. You can't go get God anyway. Oh, I suppose I have to stay in this neighborhood, will you? Yeah. You can't get him. Probably isn't there. You have to figure there is no God. Now, if you figure it that way, then you have to look at Jesus. Now, Jesus, he couldn't make God out either.
He was limited by the same things that limit us too, no matter what he said. But Jesus, more or less, simply took the place of God. With tremendous courage and tremendous love, dear selflessness. The vicar. Now, the solution for you is to do the same thing. Be God's representative. God's self-assured. And do it as Jesus did. And then this world will be all right. We will get the proper world anyway. Don't worry about eternal life. What counts is life here. And then let's go on and have a great chapter of sociology. That's Frau Dr. Zeller. And have it here in writing. And the book we have at home, too. Now, I will give you three instances of the spontaneous reaction and of their after effects, which are now making history. And they are of tremendous interest to the Lutheran Free Churches, as you can figure, who have been fighting a perpetual Kirchenkampf for 130 years or more. And my three instances are Zittensen, you can remember that name, it's simple, S-I-Zittensen, two T's. Zittensen, that was on the 12th of October, 64, so it's almost 2 years. And then the Westfalenhalle in Dortmund, that was on the 6th of March this year. And then my third example is Braunschweig. So I just give you the three instances of how things are happening and did happen. Now I'm picking up these things one after another, but I want to make the remark beforehand that I'm not citing authorities in detail, because we'll just be wasting time, but everything is in the lump list. This year's issue, four of them, they carry a foreword, which I am writing, to the end of this year, and that covers the whole subject matter, both what is happening and also the theological implications, and even a detailed analysis of the total theology of Bultmann and the Bultmannites. And I shall follow that up with a daily brief in the first issue of next year on Karl Barth and all books on Karl Barth that have appeared in the last 10 years. And there you have the documentation. Now to get back again to Zittensen. Well, this was an interesting thing, I must say myself. I went there, of course. This is in northern Germany between Hamburg and Bremen. And this is a village. And there were some people there that objected to the pastor continually attacking this most modern form of theology. He had a lot of school teachers there, too, and some higher school teachers within on the total parish there. And they said, why don't you get the men here? He did. As a representative of existentialistic Bultmannite theology, he got Ernst Fuchs von Marburg. Of course, that meant that there were so many buses of students coming along. Students from Marburg, students from Münster, students from Hamburg, buses and buses were coming in. And the representative of what Pastor Hartwig was fighting for was Professor Künnert of Erlangen. And the idea was a debate which should last the whole day, starting 9 in the morning and letting people go about 4, 4:30 in the afternoon. Yeah. And they had expected a few hundred people to come, and of course some local people. Instead of that, this village was so crowded. They have never seen so many people, even when the soldiers came in, they didn't have so many people in Sittensen. Actually, there were more than 1,000 theologians. And there were more than 1,500 lay people in addition. And they had to get their electricians moving in all the various halls which were accessible so that they could hear the thing. That was the great debate of Zittenden, and it showed there's something coming up, something in the air. Now, I don't want to tell you just how this thing went on. I'm making some remarks on Fuchs and on Kinnett after a while. But what I do want to point out right away is that the subject matter was the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And in particular, 1 Corinthians 15. And now, Professor Fuchs held forth a thesis something like this. The unity of life and death in love. That is the Bedeutsamkeit, the significance of the Easter message. The unity of life and death in love. And a casual remark of his was this. I do not care 2 cents for anything historical. It is Germany's Pfeiffer of alles historisch. Which included, of course, the historical fact of Christ actually having arisen. And another remark of his was, it is not possible to say that outside of my faith, God exists at all. Now, I'm taking all this from the tape recorder. I have the tape recording myself. And this appeared in print by Pastor in Hamburg, Kapellenpastor in Hamburg, and Fuchs has not objected, although Professor Fuchs objected to using the tape recorder and publishing that. He simply refused to give his permission. Now, his way of proving that, he always said how he was an exegete. And he said Kinnett was a systematician. Now, his great proof for this sort of an explanation of 1 Corinthians 15 was the simple fact that 1 Corinthians 13 precedes, which was supposed to be deep exegesis. Now, on the other side, there was Kinnett. And Kinnett was trying to put straight questions to Fuchs. Fuchs got about 15 straight questions and he didn't answer one. He would just swing around, bring in something new again. He always had the attention of his students. Yeah. And the moment somebody said anything decisive against him or indicated in any way that really such professors and such teachers didn't belong to the church, then the students started. They hissed through the whole church building. But the other side was quiet. They considered the church building to be, in a sense, holy and sacred. I didn't worry them. That was this great debate on the one side. Now, Kinnett, on the other side, of course, made out with great emphasis that what actually happened was that Christ rose from the dead in his true human body, and that without that fact there is no gospel at all. And that faith is something which is dependent on God announcing what he actually has done to take away our sins and to justify us for Jesus' sake. Faith then cannot believe in itself. But faith is, you might say, trusting on something outside, something extra nos, something unknown already. This was anathema to Fuchs. He always walked around it, and he was always saying that historical things have no religious value whatsoever. Now, there were some fine points, yet, for instance, Fuchs' specialty is this, and it wasn't so evident there. How many minutes have I?
About 15.
15. Yeah. Cook's specialty is something like this. You can't tear the historical Jesus and the Christ of faith apart that way, the way Bultmann does. For me, that's one unit, and the things are already implicit in what he said, or what most likely did say. Otherwise, they wouldn't have come out later on that way. That's one of his points. And here he shares that with Casemann, who came out with his essay in 1953, which was published 1954, and so forth. And then his other great thing is sort of Sprachmysticism, you see. He gets that from Heidegger. He's even more of a Heideggerite than Bultmann. And with Heidegger, it's like this. You see, when you're caught by the root cause, and this root cause you to become, to be existential, that is really to become a man, that is really to become identity. When you get this root, this cause, then this cause is a serious thing. Be something like, what do you call these things in this country? Transistor portable? As if you had a transistor portable there, and that was connected in some mysterious way with you and with something beyond. With being to which you are attached, since you are in a sense, but with being beyond. And from this here big correspondence, there comes a call. Yeah. Now don't laugh. You see, this has a lot to do with the catastrophes of World War I. You see, World War I put the philosophers out and the theologians out. All of a sudden, all this long-range thinking was out. And all this optimism was out. They didn't believe it was possible anymore to build a Kulturreich to cover the whole world. They had to have something that took the place. And now this man, Martin Heidegger from the Schwarzwald, is just as dark as the Schwarzwald. Yeah. And he has all sorts of oracle things. I read his stuff. Don't mind. I've got it down here too, but we have no time. Yeah. And for Martin Heidegger, this mysterious transition is the thing. And you see, this transition idea was now so terrifically important. Man passes through a crisis. That transition takes place. And then thereby he becomes authentic through that call. And what is this authenticity of him? It's just daring. Daring into the future. And it's just faith. Believing that although you are facing death and you're facing nothingness, and really have nothing tangible at all to expect, that nevertheless you walk forward bravely. And that is your real life. And as you do walk forward and be saved, all of a sudden there's music in the air. Music in the air, and you're on the trail of the God. Especially if you follow certain big, great tragedies written by the poet and that pet poet, Hölderlin, or the pet poet of Bultmann. Because all the pets of Heidegger are the pets of Bultmann, too. Now, then there's music in the air, and then you have a strange connection all of a sudden. You walk this solitary path, and all of a sudden there's an opening. And then there's something about you, and then you are free for the future, totally free from anything tangible. You're not figuring on anything anymore. You're just risking it, and you're free, and you're so terrifically free that in great love you meet your neighbor. Because you are so free. Oh, he's a nice boy. All sorts of things. Yeah, in Heidegger. And this made a tremendous impression on Bultmann. And come back to that later on. So with Fuchs, there's music in the air. And Fuchs is acting out existentialistic theology when he's taught. It's almost so if he, so he saw visions. He's a Swabian, by the way. He puts his whole dialect into it, too. Yeah. And then the students were so cheerful. They just thought they had won the whole battle. Now, I'm going to discontinue this description. I'll tell you what I'll do. If you want to act a play, want to play the debate, you can get the text from me. I reduce that, both in English and in German, to 10 pages. That's a nice thing. You want to play that one? It takes about 20 minutes. And then you can comment on the two theologies. Now, I want to introduce you to a literary debate. This was vocal. A literary debate between Willy Marx in Münster. And just like Fuchs, he holds the attention of the students, 500 of them assembled. He's their man, enabling and feeding him as a whole, too. And Zinkler and Heidelberg has him again. So there's something in that general atmosphere which attracts the students to these men. An older man by the name of Helmut Frey, who has published about 10 volumes on the Old Testament, as a recognized Old Testament scholar, was associated with Marxism at the theological school at Bakers, where Marxism started out. And in this crisis, he took the pen and wrote. So he wrote a book, Die Frage nach dem Zeugnis von Jesus Christus heute, this year. I just want to call your attention to a literary debate, how that is staged and how it works and how these things come in. Now, he summarizes very well. And by the way, I've read most of the books of Marx and too. I'm not just referring to what he wrote. Now, he summarizes the position of Marxism like this. This historical onward movement in history, in early Christian history, leads from an implicit to an explicit, or from an indirect to a direct Christology, and from an undefined and ungrounded absolute claim for the message to a grounding of that claim in the person of Jesus, through definition, qualification, interpretation by the congregation. And this made his person to be the object of faith, and thereby introduced the era of the history of dogma. Thus, that which is oldest and the most attainable, utmost attainable, is simply a relationship. That's really much. Summarize. Now, the strange working of, you might say, of two factors, which we will see in Bultmann too. I don't know whether I will get into Bultmann so far. It doesn't cut any ice. If you are much interested, you can read the Rundblick, and if you are terribly interested, you learn German to do so. I'm just joking. Because Germans almost all know English. Why shouldn't Americans know German? It's something like this. You have two pistons working. And the quicker the one works, the quicker the other works. Or you have two tubes. And as the temperature rises in the one tube, it pushes up the temperature in the other tube. Or you have a negative and a positive pole. And the more you charge the negative, the more the positive is charged. That's what works. And what works that way? Historical criticism, also form criticism, as a negative pose, and then this mystical religion, which relies on nothing historical at all, as the so-called positive. It's a Buddhist thing. That's the way to work. Now, I'll just read to you, I would say, a typical condensation which I called from Frey, Helmut Frey, and he puts it this way. He says, this we know,
Oh, yes, I have to get a little bit better light here, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. He says, historical understanding, the way we have it now developed, especially also in form criticism, is in an inescapable legacy ever since the Renaissance, and of course, above all, since all the scholarly work done in the meantime and in the last years. Now, if nothing remains outside of this criticism, if investigating reason is not itself called into question, since it is not contaminated by the corruption of a fallen world, and since there is no fall anyway, if all that is not empirically verifiable is radically subjected to questioning, if historical scholarship is free to correct not only the technical worldview of the first biblical witnesses, but equally also their treatment of the history of Jesus, of the facts. If the methods of historical research exercise their full authority without gainsaying to locate the original preaching figure, that Jesus, with the help of the logic governing all historical events, namely trusting to analogy, trusting to interrelatedness, and trusting to the evolution in history, if those are the criteria, and of course, all, I would say, presumptions of faith are excluded, and then in this manner and precisely in this way of the utmost renunciation and of the most severe restriction, one attains to the treasury, above all treasures, namely to the chemically pure, the sanitarized kerygma. And so he learns to believe as Jesus believed. That's the trial. That's the way Marxism has it down. I checked on the references of Fry. They're all straight. Now, Fry makes a few remarks, which I want to add yet. I think it's good to get you into that debate, you see. Here at this school, you can hold forth on Bookman yourself. The debate is not there. The debate is with us. We're next door to it. Yeah. This man, Fry, says that the radical enthusiasm of that super pietist Gottfried Arnold, who furiously demanded faith only as a relationship and not as a trite claim to have the truth, this is now finally realized. That's the one remark. And then he goes on to remark on the wonderful thing which the rationalists now achieve. To distill the gospel out of the historically limited variations and interpretations given to it in the early church. These, though they were necessary for the purpose of being understood, nevertheless were distorted. To break away from the materialized and institutionalized understanding of the sacraments by the church up to our time. To liberate the mind from the caricature of faith, which has been robbed of its eschatological relational essence, and which has been equated with a stultified conception of belief as belief in fact. And finally, to lever the church from the fraud of pushing Jesus himself aside through the objectifying of his person as the object of faith. By these actions, the critics and the rationalists have now arrived at the true eschaton. The relationship we have to Jesus, this is not quoting Marxism again, is no more and no less than the relationship we have to God. It is in this sense that Jesus is not the object, but rather the source and the originator of faith, which is to say much more. This results in an immediate relationship with God. It's Gottfried Arnold pretty close. The spiritualistic wing of pietism, with God, which is neither dogmatic nor bound to any one concept of God in F 25, and likewise is neither interrupted by any reflection nor made dependent upon some sort of external derivation. Such an immediate lineup with God cannot be produced by any title of honor or by piling up all titles of honor upon Jesus, or by all sorts of qualifications of his person. On the contrary, all these qualifications destroy the immediacy of the relationship with God. Why, page 12 and 30. And then he comes in with some further critical statements. He says to Willie Martin, "Well, what sort of history have you really got? Your book consists mostly of his must-have and his could-not-have. Is that history, is he straightjacket? If you know beforehand what can be and what cannot be, what do you call that history?" Because Martin is continually shouting, "I am a historian."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then he puts a question as to the living witnesses. He says, "Weren't they breathing the air of Israel?" "No, William Martin, how can we just make them into philosophically trained figures? We're continually engaged emotionally or passionately reflecting, interpreting, and reconstructing. Why, in reality, they stood as the bearers of grand tidings for which we would at any time have laid down their lives. William Martin, you prevail upon students to believe that by the time of the Pauline epistles, huge changes had taken place in the message. This is contrary to every possibility of history." And then his final judgment is a judgment on hypercriticism of a professional type. He says, "By using the apparently decisive results of research, long chains of fallacies are built upon false premises. And thus is reared a huge structure which has separated itself totally from reality. From this results the inability to appropriately deal with scriptural statements, and the continual secular misunderstanding of countless biblical statements caused by permitting details of the history of religion and assumptions of reason to interfere with true exposition." That's his final verdict. So here you have a literary debate. It's still going on. Martin answered again by book. I didn't take that in. Now I have another thing to mention, and I mentioned it already. There's the Braunschweig situation. And I don't think that I will get into the big Bultmann stuff, which I have here for pages and pages yet, but it's not so terrifically important because I can't get everything anyway. But now Braunschweig's a very interesting thing. Braunschweig, there's a semi-independent congregation called Brüdern. And there's a pastor there, the second pastor of this semi-independent congregation called Dr. Liebe. And at Sittensen, Dr. Liebe got more hisses than anybody. Because at the end of the debate, he simply used one single word, and that was anathema. Anathema. And then this whole church was resounding with hisses. But that is what he meant. He meant, the only action which can be taken is the action as they took it in Nicaea in 325. The Holy Catholic Apostolic Church, anathematize, tus legunda, those that say, and so forth. Now, that's what he meant. And I knew that there was something more coming. And it didn't take too long, and they brought out 18 theses which Dr. Brecher, your professor, was so kind as to translate in the September issue of Concordia Theological Monthly, somewhere in the middle. Now, what they want is a whole lot more. They want separation of in the church. There's no possibility of living together. You walk out or we walk out. There's no other choice. And they demand that the confessions which were signed by everybody, you know, they all signed them. That's a funny thing, you know. They don't sign them in any particular sense. It's just a sort of a habit to do so. Yeah. That these confessions are binding, which was the original sense. And so what he wants is a strong church which actually lives and takes action. with the full teaching of the Lutheran Church, the full teaching of the Bible, the full authority of the Bible.
No, that doesn't say that everything is perfect. I put in 5 questions already in the Rundblick number 2. And I have expanded on that in Rundblick number 3. Now, by the way, these people are tremendously thankful for the Rundblick. We had to send out 400 copies extra. And we had to reprint the first 2 articles. And they were sent all over Germany. So I am going into the details to help them. But they're on the right way. Yeah. And these various movements, of course, are getting contact with each other. And they're getting contact with us, too. We probably will have some free conferences where everybody can come in without restrictions and where we will first hear them out and see how things are moving and how close people are one to the other and so forth. But this Braunschweig movement is almost taking over in Braunschweig. So many pastors signed the faces that this almost means that the Braunschweig church cannot continue anymore that way. The way it is. Now, the great handicap is that they have only one semi-independent congregation. What a blessing that you people here have congregations built up in 100 years. And people going to church. Now, there's one man I want to refer to yet another debate which is coming. The man attacked Venantia. The man attacked is that famous Italy, which is this country too. When I was here last time, 63 that was, he just was passing through the St. Paul and had a lecture the very Sunday when I arrived in St. Paul at Luther. Abram is supposed to be a Luther scholar too, but you know, funny thing, you can change the real Jesus into something else, and can't you change then the real Luther into something else too? And can't you do that with a tremendous amount of learning? And can't you do it so that the false Luther looks almost like the real one? If you're a German, you can do that. It takes a tremendous scholarship to do that, but they can handle that. Now, Abram was attacked on another score. Rosenberg in Hesse, who's very close to us, he wrote me so many letters of thanks. He said he wanted to come down and sing, although he's not a real Lutheran yet. Rosenberg attacked him on law and gospel. Rosenberg wrote in his book, Der Sohn. That's not referring to Professor Sohn. Der Sohn, that means Jesus Christ as the Son. No. Excuse me, Professor, I'm not trying to play any fun, but I just wanted to them to remember the title of the book. Now, there's all. It's not here in your library yet, I don't think so, but you ought to get it from Brockhaus. Brockhaus in Obertau. And in this book, the attack is the following. I just want to bring out this attack. Goldberg says, am I close enough to this thing yet? No. Rodenbeck says the following. He says, the whole existentialist theology from Bultmann on, and of course from many others that preceded them already, because Bultmann is really a Kantian, and Bultmann is also at the same time a Ritschlian, and Bultmann is at the same time a Hermannite from Wilhelm Hermann. And then he became, in addition, yep, a Heideggerite. And then he arrived where he is. And he says, all this existentialistic theology, even when it tries to quote Luther, that's Abram again, trying to quote Luther on that. He said, they have no law. There's no law from the outside coming in at all. They just have a Kierkegaard substitute for preaching law and gospel. And then he's hard on Kierkegaard. He says, there's a place in Kierkegaard where Kierkegaard is very dangerous to the church, and where they try to pick him up and get the thing out of him which they wanted, namely the Ein Übung ins Christentum. What's the English title of Ein Übung ins Christentum? You have it, no doubt. Would that be
Introduction into Practicing Christianity, something like that. And there was a superscription there. There's a whole big passage in the Einleitung inscription to him where Kierkegaard says that the idea of direct communication between God and man has to be eliminated. And that by thus eliminating the direct communication, you demand faith. And so that faith is jumping into, or you might say, into a cloud, into something dark and abysmal. The whole kerygma idea, the way it's brought out, the fundamental assumption of the whole faith idea in existentialistic theology, he brings that out all in detail. And he says, this is so totally opposed to Luther that it is absolutely impossible even to mention the Reformation in connection with existentialistic theology. Because there is no wrong gospel relationship at all, although they're continually talking about wrong gospel. And they want to reform the whole church along lines of law and gospel, and they have totally taken away the law, so that, of course, the gospel has no satisfaction. Vicarious suffering of Christ, and there is really nothing which pronounces absolution in the gospel. But the gospel is a strange thing. It comes as a demand, and then the moment you believe it, then it changes, and all of a sudden it's on your side. Now this is a big thing with Rodendale, and this is taking over. I greatly encourage the men to go deeply into this thing, and I said this ought to be the first subject and also of a free conscience. Just picking up exactly the meaning of law and gospel and the way it is handled by existentialism throughout. Now, I could go into what deeper, namely Bultmann in back of it. I just gave you a little bit of a hint to changes in Bultmann, and I just want to make one comment yet. How many minutes have I? One, two, or none? Oh. Pardon? Yeah. I would call that, if you can remember from the Greek reading that you did, the little word todaimonion. Socrates refers to that. It's a sort of a God power that gets over you and drives you on into action. Todaimonion. And this is the great daimonion of the whole movement. It's this. Modern man doesn't believe any facts at all that were related to Christianity, to Christian churches, and so forth. They're all out. Now, when modern man doesn't believe anything, how can you make him believe everything? You can only do it by saying it's coming in this transistor portable radio, just that moment, in that call, at telegram. And there everything is happening. You have the whole world. And they sing all the songs. They sang the most recited songs on resurrection at Wittgenstein. Although they didn't believe a single fact, except in the moment when the call is there, the charisma. Now, this is the question now that's up to us. How shall we react to this vitification coming? That's the question up to you. Are you so solid that you can help the German churches with such a united testimony, so oriented, and with such exact knowledge of the upper-side position, and at the same time, such a deep knowledge of Scripture and the confessions, that the compromises are killed? This Kirchenkampf has no success. This must spell out the demise also of German university theology as a unit, scholarship as a unit. You think these times are over? That's what we have to pray for. I know well enough how great human resistance is. I remember well when the Second World War came on that I had a long conversation with Landesbischof Schöffel in Hamburg. And And the thing that she would simply refuse was to break up territorial churchism and to oust liberals. That time they had liberals yet, not the new type yet, fully developed. But that must simply be an impossible compromise in the future. These unit conceptions, they must go by the board. Territorialism and university theology as a scholarly unit. May God help you. May God help us.
Thank you very much.
Hi,
Brother S. I'm sorry that our time allotted to our discussion is over. So those who are planning to attend the other dialogue, please feel free to leave now. We thank you very much for having come. Those who wish to continue the discussion with Dr. S. and have nothing else planned are welcome to remain here and put some questions in there.
Will you be moderator?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Professor Volk has a question.
So you get there for 3 months, and they surely take you to town. They catch you in all the various grooves in which you're moving with your thoughts and with your expressions. That, I would say, should be the first thing. The second thing would be, should be, the selling short. Excuse me for being so blunt. Yes. And just make it a semester, make it a tool with us, and then you get the lay of the land. It's a tremendously complex situation. And then, if their German is good enough, and their general capability is first rate, well then, let him carry on and get a doctor's degree somewhere and stay in touch with us instead of just sticking around someplace and having no contact at all with the churches with which you yourself are spelled by fellowship. And then becoming the prey, the object of the doctor father. And running after the doctor father, that's the wife proclaiming his news to America. Excuse me.
All right,
sir. That's
it, sir. Just the
cousin
of Rainer Maria Lucas'
poetry. Oh, which one?
Rainer Maria Lucas.
Oh, yeah.
His poetry
has
a certain influence
on book myself. Yes, but he doesn't make such a figure of him as he does of this Heidegger. You have to understand that on the basis of his Heidegger reading. You see, Heidegger is a mysterious person. You have that, that big volume. Time was sight. Being and time. Translated by the Scots, who can translate anything under the sun. You have that here
somewhere. You care for a cup of coffee?
I wouldn't mind having a cup of milk, rather, if you have enough milk there to help me. I'm a little bit afraid of coffee, but I might not be able to sleep the way.
Well, you talked about a lot of things, Bill.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about a book that's now facing ourselves, called The Bootar, after the Fairly of Smith, of a paper you gave on the Doctrine of Inspiration and its application to the first chapter of Genesis.
Yeah.
And you got into trouble when this was reported in the Russell, because somebody said you were getting to be liberal, which is unthinkable.
I thought it was rather unthinkable too at the time. Much like people disagree.
Well, you make a remarkable statement, I think, about the days of creation. And if you don't mind, I'll ask you some new because it also helps to clarify your position and on other matters, I think. But you say there, that we have in the creation days, we have to hold that these are ordinary days because this is what Kyle once said. You quote that favorably, but these are the ordinary days. And although perhaps qualitatively, these various days, because of the immense past that was performed, may be considered different from one another because of these achievements. And to say that, because of this, the Christian Church has never dogmatized the exact length of the day or 24 hours for these days, because the first day and the seventh are simply too great for them. I'm kind of glad to hear you say that, because apparently you don't think that. This part of fundamentalism, which generally I think you stand, is defensible. And then I want to ask you how this debate came up. You give a long paper here on the application of the doctrine of verbal inspiration to the first three chapters of Genesis, and then chapter of a crowd with the other lines,
just okay.
From every eye possible.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, the summarizer for the book, Paul Reinhardt, says, you have never had a meeting like this, now it's 7 years ago.
Yeah.
You have never had a meeting like this where we went away from each other, more divided than we did with them.
Oh,
you
that's...
You that you have the same problem in the German church, even in the confessional church, at least the Christian one, between creation and what else they call, and sometimes, like we have over here.
Well, I would first answer as to that debate. This was one of the typical German debates which lasts the whole day.
Yeah.
They say you debate all morning and you debate all afternoon. And the only thing you exclude is the evening. So we were going away at it. Secondly, there were no pre-church people present. This was all within territorialism.
Always in territorialism. Thirdly, I would say that I maintain that you have to take the days as days, but you cannot, you might say, pontificate on the hours. Totally impossible in case of the first day. On account of all context, you get a night and a day and a night again. And it's impossible also with reference to the seventh day. There is no general remark on the seventh day in the usual way. And then again, on the first 3 days, there's not the rhythm, the interplay of sun and earth and so forth. And so time is fixed in a different way. And you only have to take a jet and fly around in various directions to see how difficult it is to fix the boundaries of day. And so we have to understand this in such a way that we cannot just equate that with the day the way I get the day when I'm here in St. Louis, stationary and fixed. So we have to give some leeway there, and I don't think theologians ought to say more than they know. No, on the basis of scripture, but they should not so easily say just what a farmer wants to hear.
That's a thought, too. Okay, it's you use the expression, a church called each year.
That's right.
Now, is that strictly textual? Is that strictly textual?
Textual.
Is it really a text that in Germany there is a church called each
year? Well, sure. Sure, they call it a liturgy.
You call it a church, but is it really a church?
It's definitely a church. It's coming to be a church more every single day. They set up these Arnold-timer theses, and now they have already proposed that every one of the territorial churches, also the Lutheran churches there, should make it binding upon every single pastor that they have to commune all the Reformed, and whoever belongs to them, it has to be commune.
Because it's not really a church.
Oh, well, what that is, that's like debating whether the Missouri Synod is a church.
No, it's not.
Well, you can debate that point till Judgment Day almost. That's an interesting point, but it doesn't help us too much. Wherever
it is, it's a big question.
Yeah, wherever the church is functioning, it is a church. That's our position.
Any other questions? How do your students have been able to
to ask
German
geology.
I
was there,
I think, some of them were also somewhat influenced by them,
but
somewhat
shaped their geology. Well, about 40 men and about, 18 or 16 are from territorial churches. They come to our place in order to learn the languages. We're the best place in all Germany, and to learn Hebrew and Greek within a year, and pass a state examination. And so we have people coming from various backgrounds, and then, of course, there may be some influence exercised. You know how the boys are when they're all mixed up. They live together in these dormitories, and they have their debates, and that can be a temporary situation that somebody is getting a certain influence, moving into his thinking. Come with me, sir.
Now, I'm going to ask a question about the street churches. They have been trying for many years to affect an organic union. They have been more than just the precarious thing that tends to fall apart every so often. What's the latest on this?
Well, I would say that some form of organized, you might say, organized unity, in the sense that there are no longer various free churches but just one, will be coming along in the next 5 to 6 years. But it takes time. There are a lot of detailed individual problems to be handled, also past tradition and so forth and so forth. It's not an easy thing, and it demands above all that in this present city come situation, they all line up in the same way. I mean the individual.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, I don't want to monopolize it, but I want to let you take this opportunity, Mr. Chairman, Dr. X. He referred to, they could come there, what should the American students do when they come to Germany, and they give a very good answer, and that they could come to the work for a while and get oriented. Now, I would like to say something on that point.
I used to have a different view, and since I was in Europe, and since I was in the world, and I've seen the world and see the problem a little differently. I think you folks in Germany and the Free Church, you lack the vision. You're too small in your thinking, and we too. And we also, we are American church, also as we do and have in the past, whatever decade, backed up the church and established this little one-horse seminary at Cambridge, and the one that is only a half horse, or less than that, in Paris. And then we have the other one in Nova York. Now, I believe,
but that's not the one horse affair.
Now, I believe that Europe is now moving into unity. They are having a vision because of history. Now, why should the church lag so far behind? And I believe we in America ought to put that we have one strong seminary, and since I was over Oslo and saw the layout there, I was tremendously impressed. And we ought to bring NATO to over Oslo and the man from Paris, and then get exchange professors from America, and make that the great international school which would attract students from here, and then do exactly what you say. That, and we ought to, the church is in a crisis, as you indicated, and we ought to look at it in a bigger way. And this is a bigger subject, and I think we ought to get at that. And I am sick and tired of maintaining these small little affairs there just to favor the nationalism, the local nationalism of the French or the British. So if they have one school, and I would like to emphasize this, and I think this ought to be done. Then as a church, and another thing that I was in the world, the church all over, the church in Australia, the church in South Africa, the church in Brazil, they're all worried about confessional Lutheranism, and we ought to strengthen, and this would be another way where we should do it. And I think you folks ought to take a lead in this, so don't be so bashful, and get out and have a bigger view, like I'm now.
I'm very grateful to you, very grateful, but you know, this business of going to other people and saying, well, you better pay for us. You see, that's not just exactly bashfulness, but there's a sense of honor. You can't very well do that. And so if you have that big vision, you have to demonstrate that to yourself and first get it in. We're quite ready to go along. I'm perfectly agreed that if we have a seminary where, for instance, there is a continual teaching on the part of an Englishman who really knows his business and a part of a Frenchman, and then we have English classes and French classes between the German classes, why, our students can take almost any class. We had a man from Oxford there, Professor Diamond, a so-called professor of moral theology of Oxford. He came over, he asked whether he could lecture to our students, and he brought his interpreter along, a lady who knew the lectures by heart already. And she was called upon to do anything. Julia had explained the term, and she came to me after a while and said, what's the trouble here? Well, do you people all know English? And he did. Of course they know English. And they could have had a man come to the Sorbonne too, from France, and he could have lectured in French the next day, and had his interpreter along, and would have been just about the same thing, although he would have gotten 10 questions instead of the 3. Yeah. So this can be done, and this is a mighty good idea with reference to the schism topic. You see, the more you make this a sort of a clearinghouse, the more willing these people will be from other backgrounds to push in and send their boys there. So there's an idea, but of course I don't want to be hard on the English and on the French, because they have their home problems. They have to keep up a connection in their home territory, and I wouldn't like to see the idea of simply abandoning those sites, but uniting them functionally in such a way as to get the greatest benefit for their students, the few they have, and for our students, and for the German world. So this is okay.
You're so interested in the second series of stuff. Why didn't the three churches do more in the first one?
They were not called upon to do so.
Why did their students do it?
Yeah. Well, for instance, if you take the first case and come, I risked my head, if you want to so say, twice. I was at the Brown House before the Muxi went on and told Herr Hitler, who took me instead of Herr Hitler because other people were interfering, and I told them for an hour that they would destroy Germany. And they couldn't keep these two realms apart.
because they would get into trouble with God, and they would get into trouble with all religious men. And they were in trouble with the Jews already, and asked him how many enemies they wanted, and to go down. And her husband was very sensible about it. He even asked me to transfer or to write something, and he would take it to her Hitler. And I got to, of course, Hitler didn't mind, and he didn't, he read it. And he even referred to the books he had in his library. The three books I referred to were in his library, but that was it. And then again, after Stalingrad, I went to Berlin, to Potsdam, and had a long talk with Graf Reventlow. And I told him that the situation was so...